The sight of the path filled me with resolve. I rose to my feet, randomly stumbling in the direction I faced, my knees buckling and shaking, threatening to give way with every step. When I thought my body had reached its limit, when I got to a point where I could do little more than fall forward, I saw a glint of reflection a few feet ahead of me. I blinked to clear my eyes, believing that my muddled brain had thrown a final taunt at me. But there it was again. A sliver of moonlight piercing the clouds had sailed to earth like a well-aimed arrow, ricocheting off the dirty glass window of a hunting shack. The promise of shelter, maybe a blanket, or better yet, a stove. I found a reserve of strength I didn't know I had. A final gasp of life. I dragged my feet along the cart path. The cabin had a metal door that was locked, but the window next to the door would break easy enough. I found a rock, but my fingers were useless nubs on the ends of my arms, so I picked the rock up using my wrists and forearms. I threw the rock and my body against the glass, shattering a small corner of the window. I slid my arm through the hole, reaching in, trying to grip the doorknob firm enough to turn it. My hand flopped impotently against the knob. I was so close to rescue, yet if I could not get in, it meant nothing. Dizziness washed over me again. My right leg snapped, and I fell against the hut, my left leg struggling to keep me upright. I tipped my head back and drove my forehead into the window, breaking the glass into shards that cascaded to the floor. With my elbows, I punched the remaining glass fragments out of the frame and lunged through the opening, falling to the floor, pieces of glass hooking and tearing my stomach as I fell. I crawled on my knees and elbows across the floor, taking inventory of my new digs as much as the pale moonlight would allow. A sink, a card table with four chairs, a couch, and a wood-burning stove. Jackpot! The hunters had left a small stack of jack pine logs near the stove, and beside the stack of wood, I found an old newspaper and a canister about the size of a soda can with two long-stem matches. I slid a match through my gnarled fingers and struck it against the side of the cast-iron stove. My shakes caused me to drive the head of the match into the stove with such force that it snapped the stick in two, its head falling into the darkness. Fuck! I uttered my first word out loud since I'd been hit with the whiskey bottle. The sound scraped hard against my sore throat as it came out. I slid the second match into my left hand, pressing my wrist against my abdomen to steady it. I touched the head of the match to the metal of the stove, then jerked my torso, causing the match to strike the metal hard enough to light it without breaking it. I turned the match on its side and watched the flame grow. I lit a corner of newspaper, the flame licking the dry paper, climbing quickly toward my hand, the heat from the flame feeding me, and I consumed it with a pauper's gluttony. As light from the burning newspaper filled the small room, I found strips of pine bark beside the woodpile. Stacking the bark across the burning newspaper, I watched it take to the flame. Soon I had a fire with the authority of wood. The bark led to sticks, the sticks led to logs, and in a matter of minutes, I found myself squatting before a robust fire, rotating my body in quarter turns, letting each side heat up to the edge of pain before turning. As I revolved on my imaginary spit, as my skin thawed, as my senses came back to life, the many cuts on my body found their voice. Gashes covered my arms and feet. I pulled splinters of glass from my abdomen. One particularly large scrape across my shoulder still had pine needles stuck to it. The skin on my neck, where Lockwood's belt had cut off my air, burned a reminder of how close I'd come to dying. I unwrapped the tape from around my feet, the blood chewing its way back into the capillaries and crevices of my toes, setting them on fire. I rubbed the muscles in my calves and chest and jaw where cramping from my shivering still stabbed at me like a spike. As soon as my joints thawed enough to stand up, I went to the window, fireplace poker in hand, to look and listen for Douglas Lockwood. The wind, which had been at my back as I ran through the trees, had grown to gale force. It whipped the gingham curtain and whistled as it swayed the pines outside. It sounded ominous, but it was a godsend because it carried the smell of smoke away from my pursuer. I saw no sign of Lockwood. I heard no footsteps. He had a gun, but he couldn't shoot what he couldn't find. I tucked the curtain into the window sash, trying to make certain that it covered every inch of the window, preventing the fire's light from bleeding through to the outside. I listened and waited. I would make Lockwood come inside the hut if he wanted to kill me. Now that I was ready for him, he would have a hell of a fight in his hands. I squatted next to the window for at least an hour, straining to hear footsteps or see the barrel of a gun poke through the curtain where I had smashed the window. And after an hour, I started to believe he would not find me in that hunting shack. As I peeked out to look for any sign of Lockwood, I saw the blizzard that the weathermen had predicted. Snowflakes as big as cotton balls moved sideways in the wind, cutting visibility to near zero. Lockwood would never find me now. He wouldn't be crazy enough to stay in the woods in the middle of a blizzard. I shoved a couch cushion into the window frame to further seal the hole and gave up my vigil. I looked around the cabin, now lit by a wonderful blazing fire, and saw it to be a single room about the size of a boxcar. No bathroom, no electricity, no phone. A pair of chest-high fishing waders hung from a hook on the wall near the sink. I walked over the broken glass to the waders, took off my blue jeans, which were wet and frozen, and slipped into the waders, hanging my jeans above the stove on the end of a broom handle. I found two large towels and a fillet knife in a cupboard. I took off my shirt, hanging it with my jeans, and draped the towels across my shoulders, wearing them like a shawl. I picked up the knife, touching its razor-sharp edge with my thumb, holding it in my hand, thrusting it into the shadows, killing Lockwood over and over again in my mind. I had clothes, heat, a couch, and a roof. I felt like a king. I believed in my escape. I believed that I was safe from the crazy man who'd spat Bible verses at me just before he tried to kill me. Yet, as I lay on that couch, I clutched the fillet knife in one hand and the fireplace poker in the other, waiting for one more fight. Chapter 36. That night I slept like a man on a ledge. Every crackle of the fire woke me from my fitful slumber, sending me to the window to scan the woods for signs of Lockwood. As the new day broke, the storm maintained its crescendo with the wind whipping the snow into a blinding wall of white that would make a sled dog think twice. At first light, I stepped outside into 12 inches of snow to look for a water pump. The hut had a sink with a drain, but no faucet. I didn't find a pump, so I melted snow in a pan on the stove. I had enough wood to last a couple days, and as long as I had fire, I would survive. I changed back into my blue jeans and shirt, both of which had dried overnight, and I spent the morning inspecting the cabin with the benefit of sunlight. The hunters stored very little in the way of food. I found a can of beef stew well past its expiration date, a box of spaghetti noodles, and a few spices, enough to feed me until the storm passed. I would need a coat for my trip out of the woods, so I gathered all the supplies I could find and set to the task. I made sleeves out of my two towels, turning them into tubes and stitching them using fishing line and a flattened fish hook for a needle. The towel for each sleeve ran from my wrist to my chest, where I sewed them together, leaving a collar-like hole for my head. I slid my chest waders back on, attaching the suspenders over the top of the towels to hold the sleeves in place. Then I marched around the room, stretching and testing my sartorial achievement, pleased with my creativity. Part one of my coat was complete. Around mid-morning, I cooked half of the spaghetti noodles, eating them with an odd complement of curry, paprika, and salt, washing them down with warm water. I could not remember eating a better meal. After lunch, I started making the rest of my coat. A thick gingham curtain covered the hut's only window, its bright red checkerboard pattern reminding me of a restaurant tablecloth. I cut a hole in the middle of the curtain, turning it into a poncho. Then I pulled foam padding from the arm of the couch to use for a hat. When the time came, I would fill my chest waders with pieces of cushion for insulation and tie on my hat and poncho with cords from the curtain. By the end of the day, I had a winter coat that would have been the envy of the Donner Party. As the sun began to set, I again checked the weather. Although snow still fell, it was not falling as heavily or as horizontally as before. I stepped out into snow up to my knees and realized that I would need snowshoes. I thought about that while I made supper, using the fillet knife to open the can of beef stew, cooking it on the stove until it bubbled. After supper, I sat in the light of the fire fashioning snowshoes out of 1x8 pine baseboards that I'd pried off the wall. I used nylon cords from the guts of the couch to bind the boards to the chest waiter's boots. When I finished, I smiled with satisfaction and curled up on what remained of the couch for my second night in the hut. In the morning, I cooked and ate the last of the noodles, cut the cushions into strips, stuffing my chest waiters with the insulation, and put on my gingham poncho and my hat. I doused the fire with snow, and then, before leaving the hut, I used a piece of charred wood from the stove to write a message to the owner on the card table. "Sorry for mess. Hut saved my life. I'll pay for damage. Joe Talbert." My final act was to strap the fillet knife to my hip. I could not imagine Lockwood still stalking me through the woods, but I didn't see the whiskey bottle coming either. He wanted me dead. He needed me dead. I had the ability to send him to prison for trying to kill me, if not for murdering Crystal Hagen. If he thought like me, he'd be in those woods, holed up like a hunter, rifle in hand, waiting for me to walk in front of the crosshairs. Chapter 37. Although I grew up in Minnesota, where you walk on snow almost as much as you walk on grass or concrete, I had never walked in snowshoes before, and I had certainly never walked on snowshoes made out of pine boards. It took a bit of practice before I hit my stride, each step sinking in snow up to my shin, which was a pleasant improvement over the knee-deep drudgery that would have bogged me down without the snowshoes. I broke two sticks off a dead tree to use like ski poles for balance. Each step required focus to keep the timing of my step coordinated with the transfer of weight. After 20 minutes, I had only covered about a quarter mile, but my arduous pace did not concern me. I was warm, the weather was calm, and the woods appeared to be devoid of Doug Lockwood. And despite the threat of dying dampening my mood, the scenery of the snow-covered forest was breathtaking. Just as a trickle of a brook would lead to a river, I knew that the little cart path would lead to a road and a civilization. After an hour of walking, covering far less ground than I'd hoped, I came to a road. It was little more than a break in the trees, narrow, curvy, and not yet plowed. Perhaps a gravel access road. A jaundiced sun bleeding through the clouds over my left shoulder told me that the road ran east and west. Because the northwest wind had been at my back when I'd escaped from Lockwood, I figured that heading west would take me back to the blacktop. The trail rose on an easy line, heading to the highest point of a hill. I marched toward that point, keeping cadence to a song in my head, the chant sung by the Wicked Witch's guards in The Wizard of Oz as they marched into her castle. "Oh-ee-ah, ee-oh-ah." I would pause now and again to rest, to breathe, to look for human tracks, and to take in the beauty of the day. A day that Douglas Lockwood had tried to steal from me. Behind me, the land fell in grades toward a river in the distance. A good-sized river, but I had no idea which one. It could have been the Mississippi, the St. Croix, the Minnesota, or the Red River, depending upon how long I had lain in that trunk and which direction we had traveled. As I crested the hill, I saw my first proof of civilization in 2 days. A blacktop road, plowed clean, rolling out to the horizon. 3 or 4 miles up that road, I could see a farmstead, with the silver roof of its barn shining through the trees next to a grain silo, a view that could not have been more splendid if it had been the Emerald City itself. The farm was still a long way off, and I knew I still had probably an hour before I would reach it. I also knew that I hadn't eaten enough, and that running would wipe me out. But despite what I knew, I ran. I once watched a slow-motion video of an albatross trying to take flight from a sand dune, his webbed feet slapping flat on the ground, his body lumbering from side to side, struggling to stay erect, his clumsy wings stretched out to counter the lurching and pitching of his torso. I imagined that my run down that hill in knee-deep snow fairly resembled that bird, my feet strapped to pine boards, stomping a path more zigzag than straight. I lunged from one step to the next, my arms extended to absurd lengths by the walking sticks in my hands, flailing in the air to keep balance. When I reached the blacktop, I fell backward into the snow, exhausted, laughing, enjoying the feel of sweat on my face, made cold by the winter breeze. I removed the boards from my feet and headed up the blacktop to the farmhouse, jogging most of the way, walking when I needed a rest. I reckoned by the location of the sun and the sky that I got to the farmhouse well after noon. As I approached the house, a dog stuck his head out of a doggy door and started barking to beat hell. He made no effort to advance, which surprised me, given my appearance. Green chest waders, cushion foam splaying out like scarecrow straw, arms wrapped in towels, and a red checkered curtain draped over my shoulders and tied around my waist. I would have barked at me, too. As I approached the porch and the dog, the door swung open, and an old man with a shotgun stepped outside. "Seriously?" I said, the exasperation dripping in my words. "You've got to be kidding me."
"Who are you?"
the old man asked. He spoke in a soft voice, more inquisitive than angry. He pointed the gun barrel at the ground between us. "My name is Joe Talbert," I said. "I was kidnapped, and I escaped. Can you call the sheriff? I can wait out here if you like." The dog retreated into the house as an old woman stepped into the doorway behind the man, the girth of her hips taking up much of the opening. She put a hand on the old man's shoulder, communicating to him that he should step to the side, which he did.
"You were kidnapped?"
she said. "Yes, ma'am," I said. "Jumped out of a car a couple nights ago, just before the storm hit. Been hiding out in a little cabin in the woods there." I pointed over my shoulder with my thumb. "Can you tell me where I am?"
"You're about 7 miles from North Branch, Minnesota," she said.
"And that river back there, what river is that?" I asked.
"The St. Croix," she said.
If I was right about why I had cinder blocks chained to my legs, then Lockwood was planning to dump my body into the St. Croix River. A shudder ran through my chest at the thought of how close he had come to completing his mission. I would have floated under the ice, my flesh washing away from my bones, eaten by scavenging fish, until the current cut me free of the log chain, separating my bones at the ankle. I would have bounced with the current, breaking into pieces as my body hit rocks and logs, the river spreading my remains between here and New Orleans.
"Are you hungry?" the woman asked.
"Very." The woman nudged the old man, who stepped aside, although he never put the gun away. She took me inside and fed me cornbread and milk, and waited with me until the sheriff arrived. Chapter 38. The sheriff was a big man with a bald head and a thick black goatee. He asked me politely to have a seat in the back of the squad car, but I knew that his request was one that gave me no choice in the matter. I told him my story from beginning to end. When I had finished, he called my name into dispatch to see if I had any warrants for my arrest. I didn't. But I didn't come back as a missing person, either. I hadn't told Lila where I was going. She probably assumed I had to go to Austin to deal with Jeremy and my mother. "Where are we going?" I asked, when he started the car and pulled out of the turnabout.
"I'm taking you to the law enforcement center in Center City," he said.
"You're taking me to jail?"
"I'm not sure what to do with you. I suppose I could arrest you for breaking into that hunting cabin. That's a third-degree burglary."
"Burglary?" I said, my voice rising with anger. "Lockwood was trying to kill me. I had to break in."
"That's what you say," he said. "But I don't know you from Adam. I never heard of this Lockwood guy. There is no missing persons report on you, and until I get to the bottom of this, I'm going to put you someplace where I can keep an eye on you."
"Oh, for God's sakes," I crossed my arms in disgust.
"If your story checks out, I'm not going to hold you, but I can't let you go until I get this straightened out."
At least he didn't handcuff me, I thought. In the confinement of that back seat, I could smell the pungent odor of the towels, the couch cushions, and the chest waders, an odor I hadn't noticed before. As I contemplated my scent, a thought popped into my head. I knew someone who could convince the sheriff that I was telling the truth.
"Call Max Rupert," I said.
"Who?"
"Detective Max Rupert. He's with the Homicide Division in Minneapolis. He knows all about Lockwood and me. He'll vouch for me."
The sheriff got on his radio and asked dispatch to contact Max Rupert in Minneapolis. We drove for a while without talking, the sheriff whistling in the front seat while I desperately waited for dispatch to confirm that I was not a nut job or a burglar. As the sheriff pulled into the Sally Port of the jail in Center City, the female dispatcher crackled through the radio, telling the sheriff that Max Rupert was off duty, but they were trying to locate him. I dropped my head in resignation.
"Sorry," the sheriff said, "but I have to lock you down for a while."
He parked the car, opened my door, and cuffed my hands behind my back. He led me to a booking room where a jailer had me changed into the orange uniform of a convict. When he closed the door to the holding cell, I felt strangely content. I was warm, I was safe, and I was very much alive. A nurse came in about an hour later to clean up my cuts, putting bandages on the deeper ones and antibacterial cream on the rest. The tips of my toes and fingers still lacked feeling from having been frozen, but she said that might not be permanent. After she left, I lay on my bunk to rest. I don't remember falling asleep. Later, I woke to the sound of whispering voices.
"He looks so peaceful. I almost hate to disturb him," said a voice that I vaguely recognized.
"We'd be more than happy to keep him here for a couple days," said another voice, which I knew to be that of the sheriff.
I sat up in my bunk, rubbed the sleep from my eyes, and saw Max Rupert standing at the doorway to my cell.
"Hey there, Sleeping Beauty," he said. "He told me you might need these." He tossed me a sweatshirt, a coat, and a pair of winter boots three sizes too big.
"What are you doing here?" I asked.
"Giving you a ride home," he said. "We have some catching up to do."
He turned, walking with the sheriff back toward the dispatch room while I changed clothes. 10 minutes later, I was in Rupert's unmarked squad car, the front passenger seat this time instead of the back, leaving Center City and heading to Minneapolis. The sun had gone down, but its dying glow still marked the western horizon. I told Rupert what had happened, and he listened patiently, even though I was sure that the sheriff had already filled him in. "I think he was going to dump me in the river," I said.
"That's a pretty good bet," Rupert said. "When I heard that you wandered out of the woods like some deranged mountain man claiming that Lockwood kidnapped you, I checked out a few things. Ran your vehicle information. Your car got ticketed and towed yesterday. It was parked on a snow emergency route in Minneapolis. I stopped by the impoundment lot before heading up here."
He reached into the back seat and grabbed my car keys and backpack with my cell phone in it.
"These were in your car."
"You didn't happen to find a wallet or a digital recorder?"
Rupert shook his head. "But we did find a handheld ice auger and sledgehammer in the back seat. I'm betting those aren't yours."
"No," I said.
"He was probably planning on slipping you through the ice on the St. Croix. We'd have never found you."
"I think he thought I was dead."
"Must have," Rupert said. "When you strangle someone, they tend to pass out, because the blood stops going to their head. But they're not dead yet. With the cold weather dropping your body temperature, I'm sure he thought you were just a corpse."
"I almost was," I said. "You said they found my car in a snow emergency route?"
"Yeah, parked about a block from the bus depot," Rupert said. "Lockwood could be on a bus heading anywhere."
"He's on the run?"
"He could be. Or maybe he wants us to think he's running. We checked for credit card purchases under his name, but didn't find one. He may have bought a ticket with cash, though. I also have a couple officers going through the surveillance footage from the depot. So far, they haven't found Lockwood on the tapes. We put a bolo out on him."
"Bolo?"
"Be on the lookout."
"So you believe me," I asked, "that he's the guy who killed Crystal Hagen?"
"It's looking that way," he said. "I've got enough to arrest him for kidnapping you. That'll give us his DNA, when we find him."
"We can go to his house," I said. "He was drinking from a whiskey bottle. It'll have his DNA, or we can grab his toothbrush."
Rupert pursed his lips and sighed. "I sent a squad out to Lockwood's house already," he said. "When they got there, the fire department was just wrapping up. The place was burned to the ground. The fire marshal is pretty sure it was arson."
"He burned down his own house?"
"He's trying to cover his tracks, tie up any loose ends that might point at him. He couldn't even find a cigarette butt or beer bottle. Nothing that might have his DNA on it."
"So what are we going to do next?" I asked.
"There is no we in this anymore," Rupert scolded. "You're out of this. I don't want you poking around looking for Douglas Lockwood. Am I clear? We have an investigation going. It's just a matter of time."
"But time is the problem."
"This guy almost killed you," Rupert said. "I know you want to wrap this all up before Iverson dies. I'd like that too. But it's time for you to fall back under the radar."
"He won't come after me now that you guys are involved," I said.
"You're assuming that Lockwood is rational, that he isn't the kind of guy to kill you just to make things even," Rupert said. "You've met him. Would you say he's rational?"
"Well, let's see," I said with an edge of sarcasm.
"In the short time that I was with Douglas Lockwood, he cried, spouted crazy Bible verses,
hit me with a whiskey bottle, strangled me, shoved me in a trunk, and tried to shoot me. I think we can rule out rational.
That's my point, Rupert said. You need to watch your back. If he's still around, there's a chance he'll try to come after you. He'll see you as being the cornerstone of all his problems. I assume he has your name and address. It was in your wallet, right?
Damn.
Do you have someplace you can stay for a while? Someplace he won't look? Your parents, maybe?
I can stay with Lila, I said quickly.
You met her.
I didn't mention that Lila only lived a few feet down the hall from me. I wasn't about to go back to Austin.
Rupert reached into the console between us and pulled out another of his business cards. Just in case he shows up. I wrote my personal cell number on it. If you need to reach me, 24/7.
Rupert telling me to stand down put a foul taste in my mouth. This was my project. I dug it out of the dirt. I brought it to him when he didn't want it. Now that we were so close, now that Lockwood was at the tips of our fingers, he wanted to dismiss me. He said, we have an investigation going, but what I heard was, we'll add this case to the stack of ongoing cases, and if Lockwood shows up, we'll arrest him. I closed my eyes, and a vision invaded my thoughts. I saw Carl thrashing in a river, slipping under the water, my grandfather's life jacket twisted around his arms. In my vision, I was holding onto that anchor rope, not letting go, not saving his life. Not again, I told myself. I was not finished with this project. I would figure out a way to keep my shoulder to the wheel. I would do what I needed to do to keep the investigation moving at a pace that would put Lockwood in jail before Carl died.
Chapter 39. I called Lila and asked her to pick me up at City Hall. The police were holding onto my car as evidence to be dusted for fingerprints and the like. On the phone, I told Lila some of what had happened. I finished telling her the story as she drove me back to our apartments. She touched the side of my head where the Jack Daniels bottle cut me open, letting her hand slide down to the abrasion on my neck, where his belt roughed up the skin on my throat. She asked me to repeat the words that Lockwood said after reading the diary. I struggled to remember. I think he called Crystal the Whore of Babylon, I said. He was rambling on about how I didn't understand his love for her, that it was biblical, and she was... what was it? Something about children being man's reward from God. Then he said that he does the thing he hates, and he hit me with the bottle. He sounds insane, she said.
No argument.
I kept a lookout in the drive home, scrutinizing the face of every man we passed. When we parked at the apartment, I looked around the area, examining car windshields for signs of a body in the driver's seat or a face peeking over the dash. A streetlight flickering at the end of the block made the shadows move. I thought for a second that I saw the slumped shoulders of Douglas Lockwood hiding behind a dumpster, but it turned out to be a used tire. I didn't tell Lila the reason for my newfound paranoia, but I think she understood. I hadn't fully appreciated the toll that my ordeal had taken on my body until I walked up the narrow stairs to my apartment. So many parts of my body burned with pain. My calves, shoulders, and back felt like one giant Charlie horse from having been knotted up during my convulsive shivering. Cuts and scrapes crisscrossed my chest and arms and thighs as though I'd been wrestling a razorback. I stopped at the turn in the steps to make a mental note of everything that hurt before I continued to the top. I didn't have to ask Lila to let me stay in her apartment that night. She offered. She also offered to make me some chicken noodle soup. I took her up on both. Then she led me to her bathroom and started the shower for me and left. The water felt wonderful against my skin, loosening the knots in my muscles, washing the dried blood from my hair and cleaning the dirt from my cuts. I stayed in the shower longer than normal, and would have stayed even longer than that had I not known that Lila was making soup for me. I patted myself dry, being careful not to reopen my cuts and abrasions. When I stepped out of the shower, I found some of my own clean clothes folded neatly on the toilet seat. Lila had fished my apartment key out of my pants pocket and gone next door, returning with clean boxer shorts, a t-shirt, and my bathrobe. She also brought my razor and toothbrush so that I could shave and brush my teeth for the first time in 3 days. When I walked out of the bathroom, Lila was pouring soup from the saucepan into a bowl. She had changed into her favorite oversized twins jersey and her pink pajama bottoms with matching slippers. I liked her twins jersey.
You look like you're in pain, Lila said.
Yeah, I'm a bit sore, I said.
Go lay down, she said, pointing toward her bedroom. I'll bring your soup in.
I'd feel better if you let me sleep on the couch, I said.
Don't argue, she said, pointing at the door to her bedroom. You've had a rough time. You're going to sleep in that bed, end of story.
I didn't argue further. I'd been looking forward to sleeping in a bed with a pillow, sheets, and a warm comforter. I propped a pillow against the headboard and climbed into bed, closing my eyes for a few seconds to savor the softness of her bed against my sore body. Lila brought the soup with a complement of crackers and a glass of milk. She sat on the edge of the bed and we talked about my ordeal some more. I told her about starting the fire in the cabin and the designer outfits I wore to my rescue, gingham coat and all. When I finished my soup, Lila took my bowl, plate, and glass, and I listened to the clinking as she put the dishes into the sink. Things got quiet for a moment before Lila came back to the bedroom. When she walked in, when I saw her, I stopped breathing. Lila had unbuttoned her jersey almost to her navel, the curves of her breasts peeking out from behind the fabric, the tails of the shirt sliding across the smooth silk of her bare legs. My heart thumped so hard in my chest, I was certain she could see it. I wanted to speak, but could find no words. I simply looked at her, taking in her beauty. Slowly, gracefully, she raised a hand across her chest and slid the shirt off of her right shoulder, the cloth falling to her elbow, her right breast revealed. Then she slid the shirt from her left shoulder, letting the jersey fall to the floor, her only clothing being a pair of lacy black panties. Pulling the covers down, she slipped in next to me, kissing the scrape on my chest, a cut on my arm, then my neck. She moved gently down my body, kissing my wounds, caressing my strained muscles, and touching me with a tenderness I had never known. She brought her lips to mine, and we kissed, gently, my fingers lacing through her short hair, her body pressed against mine. I ran my other hand down the curve of her back, her hip, reading the magnificence of her form with my fingers. We made love that night. Not the sweaty, clumsy, bounce-off-the-walls type of love born of alcohol and hormones, but the slow-melting, Sunday-morning type of love. She moved over me like a breeze, her lithe, sinewy body weightless in my arms. We cuddled and nuzzled and danced until she sat astride me, slowly writhing and churning. A slice of moonlight slipped through a gap in the curtains and fell across her body, her back arched, her hands braced on my thighs, her head tossed back, eyes closed. I stared in awe, taking her in, locking that vision into a place in my mind where the memory would keep forever. Chapter 40. I woke before the sun came up. Lila was still in my arms, her back pressed against my chest, her hips and thighs curving with mine. I kissed the back of her neck, causing her to stir a little, but she didn't wake. I gently breathed in the scent of her body, closed my eyes to replay last night in my head, and let the memory lull me like a fine intoxication until I fell back to sleep. I didn't wake again until my cell phone went off at around 8:30. It took me a little while to locate my pants in Lila's bathroom and fish the phone out of the pocket. "Hello?" I said, walking back to bed. "Joe Talbert?" "Yeah, this is Joe," I said, rubbing my eyes. "This is Bodie Sandin from the Innocence Project. I didn't wake you, did I?" He said. "No," I lied. "What's up?"
"You won't believe the stroke of luck we've had."
"What?"
"Have you been following the news story about the Ramsey County Crime Lab?"
"It doesn't ring a bell," I said.
"St. Paul has its own crime lab separate from the BCA, the Ramsey County Crime Lab. A couple months ago, three of their scientists testified at a trial that they did not have a written protocol for many of their procedures. The defense attorneys in the area went nuts and raised a huge stink about it, so the county stopped running tests until the protocol problem is fixed."
"How is that a stroke of luck for us?" I said.
"Well, it occurred to me that they won't be doing any DNA testing, because without proper written protocols in place, any mediocre defense attorney will get the evidence thrown out. But in your case, it's the defense that is asking for the test. The prosecutors will never challenge the reliability of the test, because to do so would force them to argue that the evidence they've been using for years is bad. I'm sorry, I'm not following. We have a lab full of scientists who are not testing anything right now because of administrative issues. I have a friend down there, and I asked her to rush our fingernail through. She said no at first, but when I explained the situation about Mr. Iverson being on his deathbed, she agreed.
You got the DNA test done?
I got the DNA test done. I have the results right here. I couldn't breathe. I think Sandin held off telling me the results for a moment just to let the anticipation build. Finally, I said,
"And?"
And they found both skin cells and blood on the fingernail, both male and female DNA. We could assume the female DNA was Crystal's.
What about the male DNA? I asked.
The male DNA does not belong to Carl Iverson. It wasn't his skin, and it wasn't his blood.
I knew it, I said. I knew it wouldn't be Carl's.
I pumped my fist in the air in a triumphant burst of energy.
All we need now is a swab of Lockwood's DNA, Sandin said. And just like that, the balloon of my elation burst. You haven't talked to Max Rupert yet, have you?
Rupert?
No, why?
Lockwood's on the run, I said. He burned his house to the ground and took off. Rupert said he destroyed any trace of his DNA.
I didn't tell Professor Sandin why Lockwood was on the run. I didn't tell him about my visit to his house, about the kidnapping. I knew that my actions, however well-intentioned, had caused Lockwood to flee. I felt sick. Lila sat up in bed, interested in my conversation. I hit the speakerphone so that she could listen in.
Well, Sandin said, we have the diary, the pictures, Lockwood's flight from justice, and burning his house down. That might be enough to get us back into court.
Is there enough to exonerate Carl?
I asked.
I don't know.
Professor Sandin spoke as if he were talking to himself, letting the pros and cons tumble from inside his head.
Let's assume that the DNA came back to Lockwood. He would simply say that he argued with Crystal that morning, that she scratched him. They lived in the same house, after all. It's possible the DNA got there without him killing her.
Lila spoke up. He said he didn't go back to the house until after she was killed.
Wait a second.
Lila scrambled out of bed, throwing on her twins' jersey as she ran out of the room.
Who was that?
Sandin asked.
That was my girlfriend, Lila, I said. It felt good to say it.
I could hear her bare feet padding to my apartment. A few seconds later, she came back with one of the transcripts open in her hand, her eyes skimming its pages.
I remember Danielle, Crystal's mom, testifying.
She flipped another page and ran her finger down the lines.
Here it is. Crystal's mom testified that Crystal had been acting depressed, so she let Crystal sleep in that morning. After Doug and Danny left, she woke Crystal up.
She read to herself for a few seconds before she read the passage aloud.
I woke Crystal up and told her to get in the shower because it always takes her so long to get ready for school.
She showered after Doug left the house, I said.
Exactly.
Lila closed the transcript.
The only way for Doug Lockwood's DNA to get on that fingernail is if he saw her after school.
If that is Lockwood's DNA, Sandin said.
If you were a betting man, I asked.
Sandin thought for a second and said,
I would bet that it's Doug Lockwood's DNA on that fingernail, he said.
So I go back to my original question, I said. Is there enough evidence without the DNA to exonerate Carl Iverson?
Bodie sighed into the phone. Maybe, he said.
I have enough to get a hearing. If we could nail down whose DNA it is, I mean, she could have scratched her boyfriend or another boy at school. Without a match, there's too much wiggle room.
So we need Doug's DNA or we're sunk, I said.
Maybe we'll find him by the hearing date, Sandin said.
I hung my head again.
Yeah, I said.
Maybe.
Chapter 41. Lila and I visited Carl that day. I needed to tell him about the DNA and about Lockwood being a fugitive. I left out the part where Lockwood kidnapped me and tried to kill me. I also left out that Lockwood may still want to kill me and that every shadow I passed made me want to jump out of my skin. We walked into Hillview, nodded to Janet and Mrs. Lorngren as we passed, and turned down the hall toward Carl's room.
Wait, Joe,
Mrs. Lorngren called out, He's not there anymore. My heart dropped into my gut.
What? What happened?
Nothing happened, she said. We moved him to a different room. I slapped my hand to my chest.
You about gave me a heart attack.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Lohengrin said. I didn't mean to scare you.
She led us down a corridor to a corner room, a nice room, where Carl lay in a bed facing a large window that framed a pine tree bent under the weight of the snow. They had decorated the room for Christmas with pine garlands looping high on the wall and Christmas ornaments hanging from the blinds and taped to the walls. Four Christmas cards stood upright, half-opened, decoratively arranged on the table next to his bed. I glanced at the cards and saw that one was from Janet and another was from Mrs. Lohengrin. Even though Christmas was over 2 weeks away, I called out, "Merry Christmas, Carl," as I entered the room.
"Joe,"
Carl smiled, whispering his words in short puffs. He had a tube in his nose feeding him oxygen. His chest rose and fell with labored breaths, his lungs barely strong enough to gather air.
"Is this Lila? How nice."
He held his trembling hand over the edge of the bed, and Lila grasped his hand lovingly between her own two hands.
"It's nice to finally meet you," Lila said.
Carl looked at me and nodded toward my face.
"What happened there?"
he asked. "Oh, that," I said, touching the cut left behind by the whiskey bottle. "I had to bounce a tough guy out of Molly's the other night." Carl narrowed his gaze at me as if he could see through my lie. I changed the subject.
"We got the tests back," I said.
"It wasn't your DNA on Crystal's fingernail."
"I knew that already," he said with a wink of his eye. "Didn't you?"
"Professor Sandin, who runs the Innocence Project, says it's enough to reopen your case." Carl thought about that for a few seconds, as though he needed time to let the words break through the wall he had built up over the last 30 years. Then he smiled, closed his eyes, and allowed his head to sink into his pillow.
"They'll undo my conviction."
And with those words I knew that despite his stoic protestations to the contrary, he did care about being exonerated. Clearing his name mattered more to him than he had allowed anyone to see, maybe even more than he himself understood. I began to feel a weight pressing down on me, forcing my shoulders into a slump. "They're going to try," I said, glancing at Lila. "They're going to set a hearing. It's just a matter of time now." The words slipped from my lips before I realized what I had said. Carl chuckled weakly and looked at me.
"That's the one thing I don't have."
Then he turned his attention back to the window.
"Did you see the snow?"
"Yeah, I saw it," I smiled. The snow was a thing of such peace and beauty to Carl, but it had nearly killed me.
"Quite the storm," I said.
"Glorious," he said.
We visited for almost an hour, talking about the snow, the birds, the bent pine tree. We listened as Carl told stories about his grandfather's cabin at Lake Ada. We talked about everything under the sun, except his case. It was like talking about the solar system without mentioning the sun. Everyone in that room knew that Carl's exoneration would not come until long after he was dead. I suddenly felt like that 11-year-old kid again, watching my grandfather thrash in the river. As Carl's energy waned, we said our goodbyes, not knowing if we would see him again before he died. I did my best to hide my sadness from Carl as I shook his hand. He smiled back with a genuineness I couldn't understand. I found myself wishing that I could be as accepting and certain of my life as he seemed to be of his at that moment. We stopped off at Mrs. Lohengrin's office to thank her for moving Carl to a nicer room. She handed each of us a peppermint candy cane from a box that she kept on her desk and motioned for us to sit down.
"I couldn't help but overhear you say something about DNA," she said.
"One of the dead girl's fake fingernails broke off in the struggle," I said.
"It still has the Keller's DNA on it. They tested the DNA, and it wasn't Carl's."
"That's just wonderful," she said. "Do they know whose it is?"
"It belongs to... I mean...
It should belong to the girl's stepfather, but we don't know for sure. Right now, all we know is that it could be any man in the world except Carl Iverson.
Is he dead?
She asked.
Who? The stepfather.
I shrugged my shoulders.
He may as well be dead, I said. He's missing, so we can't get a sample of his DNA.
Does he have a son?
She asked.
Yeah, why?
Don't you know about the Y chromosome?
Mrs. Lorngren said.
I know there's such a thing, but I'm not sure I follow.
She leaned forward on her desk, placing her fingers together like a principal about to impart a lecture to some hapless student.
Only men have a Y chromosome, she said. A father will pass his genetic code to a son through the Y chromosome. Those genes are almost identical. There is very little change between the father's DNA and the son's. If you get a sample of the son's DNA, that'll exclude any man who is not a direct male relative of the son.
I stared at her, my jaw slackened with amazement. Are you like some kind of DNA expert?
I do have a nursing degree, she said, and you don't get one of those without understanding biology. But,
she gave us a sheepish smile,
I learned about the Y chromosome from watching forensic files on TV. It's amazing what you can learn from those shows.
I said, so all we have to do is get the DNA of a male relative?
It's not that easy, Mrs. Lorngren said. You would have to get the DNA of every male relative that was alive 30 years ago. Sons, brothers, uncles, grandpa. And even then, all you would be doing is increasing the likelihood that the stepfather is the culprit.
What a great idea, I said. We could show that it's Doug's DNA by using a process of elimination.
Lila said, I thought that Max Rupert said to stay out of this case.
Technically, he said to stay away from Douglas Lockwood.
I smiled at Lila. I'm not going after Douglas Lockwood. I'm going after everyone except him.
By the time we left Lorngren's office, I felt like a kid with a brand new pair of sneakers anxious to try them out. I could barely control the flurry of ideas that whipped around in my head as Lila and I drove back to her apartment. When we got there, we pulled out our computers. She researched Mrs. Lorngren's information on the Y chromosome, and I scanned the web for any information about the Lockwood family tree. Lila found some terrific websites on DNA, proving that Mrs. Lorngren was right. She also found that Walmart sold paternity DNA kits that had swabs in sterile packaging, kits we could use to gather skin cells from the inside of a cheek. I, on the other hand, found very little in the way of Lockwood relatives. I found a man named Dan Lockwood, with the correct date of birth, living in Mason City, Iowa, and working as a security guard in a mall. It had to be Crystal's stepbrother, Danny. I stalked his Facebook page and any other social media I could think of, and found nothing to suggest he had a male relative. Not even a father. That didn't surprise me. If I were Danny, I would have done my best to deny the existence of that Bible-thumping psychopath, too. I came away hopeful that we would not need to track down too many Lockwood men in order to point a finger at Douglas. So how should I go about getting Danny to give me his DNA? I asked Lila.
You could try asking him for it, she said.
Just ask him for it? I said. Excuse me, Mr. Lockwood. Can I scrape a few skin cells off your cheek to use to convict your father of killing your stepsister?
If he says no, then you're no worse off than you are right now, she said. And if that fails...
She let her words trail off, as if contemplating a plan.
What?
I asked.
All we need is some of his spit, she said. Like on a coffee cup, or a cigarette butt.
I found a story from California about a guy named Gallego. The cops followed him around until he threw away a cigarette butt. They picked it up and had his DNA. He went to prison. If all else fails, we follow Danny around until he drops a cigarette butt or throws a coffee cup into the trash.
We? Who's this we you keep talking about? I said.
You have no car, Lila said. Yours is still in evidence, remember?
She leaned over the table and kissed me.
Besides,
I'm not letting you finish this without me. Someone has to make sure you don't get clobbered with another whiskey bottle. Chapter 42 Dan Lockwood lived in the older, blue-collar section of Mason City, Iowa, a block north of the railroad tracks, in a house that blended in with every other house on the street. We drove past it twice, double-checking the house number with what we found on the internet. After the second pass, we drove through the alley behind his house, bouncing over potholes, dodging snowdrifts, and looking for signs of life. We saw a garbage can overflowing with white trash bags standing guard next to the back door of the house. We also saw that someone had shoveled the path through the knee-deep snow connecting the house to the alley. We made a mental note and continued on for a few blocks to park and go over our plan one last time. We had stopped at Walmart in the drive down and picked up a paternity test kit, which had 3 cotton swabs, a specimen envelope, and instructions on how to scrape skin cells from the inside of the cheek. Lila had the kit in her purse. We decided to be straightforward. We would go to Dan's house, ask him about any male relatives alive back in 1980, and then ask him to let us swab his cheek. If that failed, we would go to Plan B. Follow him around until he spit out his gum or something like that. "You ready?" I asked. "Let's go meet Dan Lockwood," she said, putting the car in drive. We parked in front of the house, walked up the front sidewalk together, and rang the doorbell. A middle-aged woman answered the door. Her face was prematurely aged from smoking cigarettes, the smell of which hit us like the slap of a glove. She wore a turquoise tracksuit and blue slippers, and her hair looked like a wad of burned copper wire. "Could we please speak with Dan Lockwood?" I asked. "He's out of town," she said, her voice thick and low as if she needed to clear her throat. "I'm his wife. Can I help you?" "No," I said. "We really need to speak with Mr. Lockwood. We can come back."
"Is this about his old man?"
she said. We had already started to turn from the door, but stopped in our tracks. "You're referring to Douglas Lockwood?" I said, trying to sound official.
"Yeah, his old man, the one that's missing,"
she said. "As a matter of fact," Lila said, "that is why we're here. We were hoping to speak with Mr. Lockwood about that. When do you expect him back?"
"He should be home pretty soon," she said. "He's on his way back from Minnesota as we speak. You can come in and wait if you want."
She turned, walking back into her house, pointing to a brown vinyl couch.
"Have a seat."
An ashtray on the coffee table teemed with cigarette butts. A few were Marlboro, but most of them were Virginia Slims. "I see you're a Marlboro fan," I said.
"Those are Dan's," she said. "I smoke Slims."
Lila and I exchanged a glance. If Mrs. Lockwood left the room for even a second, we could simply pick up our DNA sample. "You said Mr. Lockwood was in Minnesota?" I said.
"You guys look awfully young to be cops," she said.
"We're not cops," Lila said. "We're from a different agency."
"You mean like social service or something like that?"
Mrs. Lockwood said. "Did Dan go to Minnesota to look for his father?" I asked.
"Yeah," she said. "Headed up there when he heard that his dad was missing. He left the day of that big storm."
I looked at Lila, confused by what Mrs. Lockwood said. "Did Dan go up to Minnesota before or after the storm?" I asked.
"Friday, just before the storm hit. He got snowed in up there. Called me a few hours ago saying he was on his way back."
I went over the math in my head. Doug Lockwood kidnapped me on Friday. The storm strengthened that night while I hid in the hunting cabin. I weathered the storm through Saturday and walked to the farmer's house on Sunday. As far as the police in Minnesota knew, Doug Lockwood wasn't missing until Sunday. "Just so we're clear," I said, "he told you his dad was missing before he went up?"
"No," she said. "He got a phone call on Friday about, what time was it? Late afternoon. I can't remember exactly. He was all freaked out and said he has to go up to the old man's place. That's all he said, and out the door he went."
"How do you know that Doug Lockwood is missing, then?" Lila asked.
"On Sunday, I received this call from some cop. Wanted to talk to Dan. I told him Dan wasn't home. So he asks who I was, and have I seen Dan's old man lately. I told him no."
"Was the cop a guy named Rupert?" I asked.
"I'm not sure," she said. "Could be. But then that bitch of a stepmom of his calls here," she says, pursing her lips.
"Stepmom? Danielle Hagen?" I asked.
"Yeah. She ain't talked to Dan in years. Probably wouldn't spit on him if he was dying of thirst. She called him Sunday to give Dan shit."
"What all did she say?" I said.
"I didn't actually talk to her," she said.
Thought it might be that cop again, so I let it go to the answering machine.
What was your message?
Lila asked. Oh, let's see. She says something like, DJ, this is Danielle Hagen. I just wanted to tell you that the cops were here today looking for that piece of shit father of yours. I told him I hope he's dead. I hope...
Wait a second, I said, interrupting her. I think you got that backwards.
You mean that she called to tell you that DJ was missing?
DJ's not missing. His old man's missing. Doug's missing.
But, I stammered. Lila picked up where I stumbled.
But Doug is DJ, she said. Douglas Joseph. His initials are DJ.
No, Dan is DJ.
Mrs. Lockwood looked at us as if we were trying to convince her that day was night.
Dan's middle name is William, I said.
Yeah, but his dad married that bitch Danielle when Dan was a little kid. She liked to be called Danny, thought it made her sound like a tomboy. And since there couldn't be two Dannys in the family, she made everyone call her Danny and call him Danny Jr. After a while, they just called him DJ.
My head began to swirl. I'd been wrong about everything.
Lila looked at me, her cheeks pale, her eyes telling me what I already knew. We were in the living room of Crystal Hagen's murderer.
Well, here's Dan now,
Mrs. Lockwood said, pointing at a pickup truck pulling into the driveway.
Chapter 43.
I tried to think, to come up with a plan, but all I could hear was the cursing of my own thoughts. The truck passed by the window and rolled to a stop in the driveway beside the house. The driver's door opened, the setting sun casting enough light for me to see a man dressed and built like a lumberjack and with a military haircut step from the truck. I looked at Lila, beseeching her with my eyes, hoping that she could think of an escape.
Lila stood up as if a current of electricity had coursed through the cushion under her butt.
"The forms," she said. "We forgot to bring the forms in."
"The forms," I repeated.
"We left the forms in the car,"
she said, tipping her head toward the front door. I stood up beside Lila.
"Of course," I said,
as both Lila and I started backing toward the door.
"Will you excuse us? We, have to get the forms from the car."
The man rounded the corner of the house, heading up the sidewalk toward the front porch. Lila walked out the door and down the three porch steps, almost running into Dan Lockwood. Lockwood paused at the bottom of the steps, his face frozen in surprise, waiting for someone to explain why we were walking out of his house. Lila said nothing. No greeting, no explanation. She walked past him, not even making eye contact. I followed, attempting to do the same, but I couldn't help but look at him. He had his father's face, long, pale, rough. His thin eyes watched me, narrowing to look at the bandage on the side of my head, and then at the abrasion on my neck. We picked up our pace as we headed down the sidewalk toward Lila's car.
"Hey,"
he called after us. We kept walking.
"Hey, you,"
he called again. Lila climbed into the driver's seat, and I jumped into the passenger seat. Only then did I turn to look at Lockwood, standing at the bottom of his porch, not sure of what he'd seen. Had Doug told him about the whiskey bottle? About the belt? Is that why he looked at me so carefully? Lila drove away while I watched behind us to make sure Lockwood didn't follow.
"Danny killed his sister," Lila said. "When Doug and Danny both lied about being at Doug's car dealership, I thought that Danny was lying to protect his father. But it was Doug who lied to protect his son, and the diary..."
"Danny was 18 that fall," I said. "That's what Andrew Fisher told us. Danny was an adult in the eyes of the law."
"He was 18 and Crystal was 14. That's the rape Crystal wrote about."
"Christ, that's what Doug was talking about," I said, wrapping my hand across my forehead. "That night, when he tried to kill me, when he was talking all crazy and spouting Bible passages, I thought he was just being a sick bastard, confessing to molesting Crystal, but he was talking about protecting his son. He knew that Danny killed Crystal. He told the cops that Danny was with him when Crystal was murdered. He wouldn't have lied about the alibi unless he knew. He's been protecting Danny all these years. When I showed up at Doug's house with the decoded diary, he tried to kill me to protect Danny."
"The call,"
Lila said. "The one Danny got on Friday." "That had to be Doug calling Danny, to let him know about me," I said.
Doug must have called him after he thought he'd killed me, to figure out what to do with me, with my body.
It's been Danny behind everything all along, Lila said with a shudder. I've never been so close to a murderer before.
Her eyes lit up with an epiphany.
Jesus, I bet he's the one who burned Doug's house down, to destroy any trace of Doug's DNA.
What?
But think about it, she said. You go to Doug's house, believing Doug's the murderer, that it's Doug's DNA under Crystal's fingernail. When you escape, Danny knows that you'll bring the cops looking for Doug. They'll get his DNA from the whiskey bottle or something in the house, but Doug's DNA won't be a match. It'll be close. It'll be a male relative of Doug.
Son of a bitch, I said.
Danny destroys all traces of Doug's DNA by burning his house so that we'd go on believing Doug's the killer.
I let the pieces of the puzzle fall into place for a moment, before I was struck by the next horrifying step.
But he can't get rid of all of Doug's DNA unless he gets rid of Doug.
Lila finished my thought.
He kills his own father? That's insane, I said.
Or desperate, Lila said.
What would you do to avoid dying in prison?
Damn. I tapped my fingers against my thigh.
I should have grabbed a cigarette butt before we left. We were so close, I could have reached out and picked one up.
I panicked too, Lila said. When I saw that truck pull in, I freaked.
You freaked?
I said. What are you talking about? You got us out of there. You were amazing. I pulled out my cell phone and started digging through my pockets.
What are you doing?
Lila asked. Max Rupert gave me his private cell number. I shoved my hands deep into each of my pockets as if his card might have somehow shrunk to the size of a postage stamp.
Crap. What's the matter?
It's on the coffee table at the apartment. Lila hit the brakes, pulling onto a side road.
We gotta go back, she said. Are you out of your mind?
Lila put the car in park and turned to me.
If we're right, then Danny burned down his dad's house and maybe even killed his own father just to stay out of prison. His next move will be to burn down his own house and disappear. He'll hightail it to Mexico or Venezuela or someplace, and it'll take years to find him, if ever. If we can get a sample of his DNA, it'll match what they found on the fingernail. There'll be no question about it. The cops might eventually hunt Lockwood down, but in the meantime, we can get Carl's conviction overturned. But we have to act now. We have to get his DNA.
I'm not going in there, and I'm sure as hell not letting you go in there.
Who said anything about going inside?
She smiled, putting the car back into drive.
All we're going to do is pick up some garbage.
Chapter 44. The sun had dropped low in the west, leaving the avenues and alleys of Mason City lit with the mixture of street lamps and Christmas lights. Our plan was